Well, ladies and gentlemen, certainly an afternoon filled with a little bit of a global atmosphere, if you will. Certainly we had, a little good strong Canadian influence yesterday with Brian Van Dormel, and certainly welcome another part of the globe this afternoon. And I think it's a great opportunity as we see these three gentlemen frequently through the year and through many events. This is one other time that we get to share their knowledge and the experiences that they've had globally. They're going to have lots of insight and some of the changes and the developments and how they've grasped. On my left, Jan de Vries, and they'll give some introductions a little bit about both their companies as well. But certainly, Jan is a very significant player, and you certainly see his name in an umbrella of companies, if you will. And I think it certainly shows the team that he's built, the admiration that he has for genetics and for the industry as well, Jan. So I won't touch on all your umbrellas at this time. You can mention them, but certainly it's been a pleasure to get to know you the past number of years. And certainly when I have those opportunities, it's always at a very strong event. It's well received. So welcome and pleasure to have you here as well. Declan Patton, I've got to know Declan over the years, and he's got a little Australian accent. So if you can't understand everything he says, you can get to join my place, because I get to speak with him frequently and I usually don't understand much that he says either. So I have asked him to kind of just use a little more Illinois accent and a little less Australian today, but we'll participate as that. Certainly a breeder and certainly a marketer through many aspects of the country, and at Butler View for the last little while. You can certainly see his drive and his passion as well. And I've got to know Declan in Australia over my travels there, and certainly a great following and all kinds of innovation, and certainly a great family of partnerships and relationships that you've built there through the years. Paul Hunt is with us today as well. Paul's had a number of passports, if you will, with Canada, the U.S., and the last years, a few months in Holland, and been at Elta Genetics in his current position. He's been at Elta for just over 20 years, and currently the COO of Elta Genetics, and been a great friend and a great colleague through the years as well. So welcome, Paul. But to show your welcome as we show your appreciation for these guys as we drain their brains for the next few minutes. So welcome, guys. Jan, I'm going to start with you. I'd like, certainly you've got a lot of umbrellas, as I indicated, I think, from this group, that they'd like to really hear about a little bit about what's behind Jan de Vries and all the umbrellas that go. So a little overview of your company and the current position and the teams that you've built, please.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation. It's a great honor to be here after all these tremendous speakers which we have heard. It's quite a task to sit here then. Well, my name is Jan de Vries, born in Utrecht, the Netherlands. My grandparents from both sides had dairy farms. Later my uncles took over, the brothers of my parents. I always worked there as a kid and during university and school. In 1999, I came to the US to do a practical period for Gerland Farms at the time. By the end of the practical period, I get the choice, what I wanted, $1,000 or an embryo. At that time, I was not really involved in genetics or whatsoever, so I chose for the embryo. And that's where it was all starting. The embryo later on changed into six embryos. We got three bulls, which all three went to AI, and then two heifers. So by the end, I had 26,000, which I thought it was a good business, so I had to go further in that. In 2001, during my university, during my study, I started Diamond Genetics. It was a project for the university to start your own company. We didn't stop after I finished university, but I continued. Worked for 1 year Holstein International, but then it wasn't possible anymore to combine that with my diamond genetics. Developed diamond genetics for 6 years. We did the sales for Eurogenes at the time. Then in 2006, we purchased Eurogenes. I forgot one important thing with we. It's me in the company and my partner, Lambert Hillema. Lambert Hillema is 75. He's one of my father's best friends. He joined us in 2002. So in Eurogenes, we developed that for 4 years. Then in 2010, the whole genomic thing came along, and we realized that we had to do something if we wanted to stay in this business. So at that time, we made some steps. We purchased AMS Genetics in the US and started Holstein Plaza. We started with Worldwide Series Germany, trading company in Germany, Holstein Select. And we started trading companies, Diamond Genetics France and Diamond Genetics UK. All companies are independent. And then we also started in a business which we thought we would never go into, and that was the semen. So we went into AI Total, to joint venture with AI Service Southwest Friesland, which is a group of inseminators in the north of the Netherlands. So that was in 2010. We developed that for the last 4 years, and in 2014, we've started another company, AI Total US LLC. So that's the umbrella of companies that I'm busy with these days. And
I guess just I'm going to ask a couple that I was. What about where's Holstein Plaza and Hotspots fall into that umbrella, Jan? Just as you're giving your intro, please.
Holstein Plaza is, falls under the AMS Genetics, and Hotspots we started in 2010, and Hotspots is kind of covering. It's made by all the people from all different companies, and we do that all together.
Thank you. I think that's certainly a couple entities that we see, you know, frequently in the field. So I think it's good to touch on them as well. Declan, as you introduce yourself and about your background and how you see things moving forward a little bit with some of your trends as well as you've been globally around as well.
Yeah, thanks very much, Roger. And I'll try to speak as slowly as possible so everyone can understand me. As Roger mentioned, I'm originally from Australia. I'll kind of work backwards a little bit. Because that's how us Australians do. So for the last 3 years or 2.5 years, I've been working at Butlerview Farms under Jeff Butler and family. I started there working in the barns, milking the cows and, working hands-on. As time progressed, I started to do more of, the sales and management roles. So currently my position at the farm is the genetics and sales manager. So a part of that umbrella is I work with, manage the embryo program at Butlerview. So currently we're IVFing roughly around 85 donors every 2 weeks. And my job there is to do all the matings and manage that program. Also, with the conventional flushing, I guess that entails the sales side of my business, of the business. So, I do a lot of the embryo sales globally. So that's pretty much, with a lot of other responsibilities as well. But that's kind of the main roles there I have at Butlerview. Before I worked at Butlerview Farms, I worked 3 years with ABS in Australia. So I started there as a progeny test coordinator. So me and another girl did half of Australia each in the regions. And so I worked with our Young Sires program and product development and also marketing with ABS. My original background is on a dairy farm. So my family had a 200 cow Holstein dairy. We used to do a lot of showing of animals, and I've always been interested in the genetic side. And in Australia also, I had an embryo business, Designer Embryos. So that's pretty much sums up most of my responsibilities and a little bit of history on myself. So,
thanks, Declan. And we understood you clearly, so well done. Paul, you've given a little introduction and certainly your position, and certainly you've seen a lot of change as well as you've moved around globally as well. Paul Hunt.
Thanks, Roger. Oh, I thought I was going to get off. No, wasn't exactly sure how I got on the international panel, because I think, you know, when you're in the U.S., they kind of try and decide whether they're going to call Canada a partner or the 51st state or what it is. But I got thinking about all the other speakers, and I knew from the start I wasn't smart enough to get a PowerPoint presentation. I didn't get one of the real choice slots, because you have to be really smart to do that, so I don't qualify for that. And I never bought a good enough bull to sit with the dirty half dozen that were up here killing horses. I mean, I don't know if PETA is going to get real upset with them, but the number of horses those guys killed was incredible. So I don't know, and I'm not young enough to sit with these guys. So I think Jeff just decided he'd throw me up here to see if he'd make me squirm. But as you said, I've failed enough at what I've done to end up 21 years with Alta, currently chief operating officer, which allows me to do, I guess, a lot of things I like. Have done a lot of different things. So started out more like Declan, selling embryos and live cattle in 1994, went through marketing, sales, RSA work, didn't buy any good bulls. About 10 years ago, came into the role of chief operating officer. Right now, responsible for product development, peak program, the housing and distribution of semen, sales in Russia. I haven't met Putin, but seems like a nice guy. If you're listening, Mr. Putin, that was for you. It's been a great ride. 21 years with one company seems like a long time, but when I saw there was a lot of 20-year people in all these things. It takes a lot of passion to be in our industry. I think that's the one thing that I always appreciate about coming to any event like this. We don't have 1,000 people in the room, but if we look at each person and the reason they're here, what I find pretty unique is the incredible level of passion that each person has for their role and position within the within our industry. And I really commend the people putting this together, Jeff, the Holstein World, Jetstream, in bringing such a passionate group of people together. So hopefully we explore some of that passion on the international base. I'll try and keep mine about that.
Hey, that's great, Paul. Certainly I've been able to. The one important thing that Paul just didn't mention, that one of the first jobs he ever had was he worked for me. So he worked for me for a week, and he lost about 18 pounds that time. So I guess if he tolerated that, then things went on quite a bit faster after he got over that speed bump. So Declan, kind of going through a little bit of some questions, and certainly Australia is, you know, everybody globally looks at it with, you know, as not only a getaway place for us cold climate guys in the wintertime, but certainly with the, there's been a lot of changes within the industry down there, reseller market, certainly a different structure than a lot of other countries, and, you know, grazing and their exports that they've been attracted to over the years, they've experienced a lot of things. And with your knowledge, and certainly with your farming background, I think you could share some trends and some market appeal that Australia has experienced down under.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Roger. I guess I'd like to start with that. You know, what I've been getting from the conference, the last couple of days, that, you know, one thing I wanted to touch on is, you know, we need cows that are, you know, medium size with a lot of strength, and that lasts a long time. So I'm not sure why John Sheffers didn't think Australia had good cows. So, but just to give a little bit of an overview of Australia, we have over 6,500 dairy farms. We produce around 9.5 billion litres of milk per year. We have around 1.7 million dairy cows, and you know, our average herd size is obviously, you know, quite large. So we're around 280 cows is our average herd in Australia. Obviously, a majority of that is pasture-based, so it makes us a little bit different to obviously North America. But we're a $13 billion, you know, industry within Australia with our agricultural industry, and about $4 billion to our farm gate. So, but obviously, you know, being a pasture-based system, you know, we have a different index. But you know, I think the changes and the trends, you know, where different parts of Australia are rapidly changing. So, you know, we're going more from a pasture-based system to a system where, you know, we're having a lot of more imports, a lot of more supplements, You know, and we see that as a growing trend. And because of that, we're seeing a lot, you know, a lot of different use in, you know, with the size selections and with the management of our animals. So, you know, genomics is certainly one thing that, you know, is, you know, growing in Australia. It's taken a little bit more time to see that trend grow. Certainly on the male side, you know, with my experience with ABS, we were selling quite a lot of genomic semen. But, you know, with our systems, I guess we'll touch on that a little later, but with our APR system, but our change of management, we're looking at more of the North American genetics, you know, so the TPI, the LPI. So, you know, we see, you know, a rapid growth in genomic technology from North America. So I think that's one of, you know, probably the major changes, you know, going from pasture-based to, you know, more supplementary you know, diets. We'll see that continue to grow in the country. And, you know, a lot of that is due to the weather patterns. You know, Australia can be hot one day, it can be cold the next, luckily not as cold as Illinois. But, you know, the weather can it can be quite dry in the country, so people are looking at, you know, using supplements for, you know, for our herds. It's a little bit easy to manage, so.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, certainly, you know, when you get one of your bushfires, by the time it gets on the media over here, we don't think there's anything left of Australia, but they take it a little bit out of proportion sometimes. But certainly you guys are a pretty resilient group. You know, certainly drought has changed the course of a lot of farmers in the regions over there, and certainly the fires have taken a lot of acreage and a lot of farms over time as well, but they can seem to certainly battle on as well. Jan, certainly with well, you've seen as much in your short period of time, and certainly had a lot of wore different hats getting there. So a little overview on perspective and how some of the trends that you've seen and within your umbrella.
Thank you. Well, if I look at what's happening currently in Europe, is that the quota system is disappearing. We're a couple of weeks away from that. And that's going to influence the dairy industry quite a bit. We see farms getting bigger and bigger in a rapid scale. Farms who want to stop raising their own young stock and just milk cows. If look from the Netherlands, the land is always the limiting factor. It's very expensive, and they put up now strict manure rules and mineral rules for how many animals you can have per hectare. So for that reason, it doesn't pay off to raise your own young stock, and even breeders, which we have worked with for many years, and who do a lot of flushes, now call us if we want to take over their young stock rearing and deliver 2-year-olds. So that's going to be quite an impact in for the upcoming period on the how is that going to influence everything. The politics is also getting really involved in that. We got a new dairy industry law coming up, and they have clear ideas about the maximum size of cows, and in some provinces you're not allowed to or it's very difficult to get licenses for building dairy farms over 500 cows. So that's a little bit of political situation in the moment. Then we have of course the genomic discussion and acceptance and all of that. I've also been a little bit active myself in that discussion. In Europe, it's still like it was here in the beginning, that it's restricted access to the AIs and the co-ops who have formed that. There's now coming some change in that. The Germans, they want to open it and come with a system similar to the US. Other European countries are not in favor of that, and there comes to a point that maybe your genomics is going to split with the ones with France and the Netherlands and then Viking, Scandinavian one group, and the Germans on the other one. That's going to be interesting to see how that will go. They are discussing a formula, a new index that should be a counterpart or an alternative for the TPI. So we're going to see how that's going to develop. That's most of what.
Yeah, that's good. certainly, there's certainly it'll drive some questions, Jan. So I mean. We certainly realize that English is your second language, and you certainly do a tremendous job at it. So Coming down to Paul, and certainly, you know, with wearing lots of different hats, you might come at our question a little differently approached, but certainly welcome your market trends, changes, and intro. Thank you.
Yeah, if I look at the trend, I think the panel today talks about one of the trends, and I think the biggest trend we're faced with is globalization of our industry. I think there's a number of drivers of that. First of all, consolidation. There's fewer and fewer companies out there, and that's not just in the AI business. That's in milk production, milk marketing. We see a lot of globalization going on. We see more and more need to collaborate to have the scale that's needed to meet producer needs. And you know, specific to today's meetings, I think we see that genetics is beginning to play a role with the rate of genetic gain that we're making. Dairymen who are able to make that genetic gain are more likely to be in the business now and in the future. And so genetics is one of the big drivers of that consolidation, globalization. Given that we're here in the U.S., I think one of the big drivers of that globalization is also the fact that we're, as the great slides yesterday showed, we're at the heart of genetic improvement for the Holstein breed. When we see the scale of reproduction, the quality of genetics, I think if as Jan wishes would come true and we had a genomic test on every animal and every base so that they all had some reason to sell, I think what we'd find is that probably the highest animal on almost every base likely was born here in the U.S. It's just the scale of reproduction that takes place, the quality of animals. We all want highly productive, healthy cows. Some people want them to look good, some people don't. We can argue about that one. I think when they look better, it's obviously better. Why have ugly cows? But we see that genetics is a real driver to that globalization and consolidation. I think a great trend that I like to celebrate, or I think we can all celebrate, is the value of genetics. We'd not done a great job as an industry, selling and promoting the value that lie in genetics. And I think genomics has been a real boon for us in that regard, a real help. We look at least from what the one company knowledge I have, we see more and more units of semen being sold. We see people trusting in genetics, realizing that if they spend more for a better genetics, they're going to get better results. It's that kind of trusting relationship that I think helps us to get over the initial lukewarm feelings that may have existed in some areas on genomics. I think everybody's finding that it's not quite the terrible unknown that some people worried about. So I think again, we're going to end the conference with what I think is the tip of the iceberg. We are in a world that needs protein. We create protein in a lot of different ways. We've attracted a lot of people to our industry because of that need, but also because we have a science-based approach to value creation. I think we're going to see that when we look at the animals that are leading that genetic improvement head to the auction block tonight, that we'll see that respect shown in the great American way, a capitalist way, and I think that's a real testament to where the industry has been professionalized and taken to a new level of performance. I do think it's great to have a conference like this. I think the one trend that, I don't know if it's a trend, but I think we're in the middle of a game change. I think it's always tough to step far enough back when you're going 100 miles an hour to know what the real changes are. I heard a number of people, you know, talk about, you know, trends in the industry. You know, it may sound a little bit self-serving, but people say, hey, you know, Alta doesn't buy as many bulls as they used to. Well, I used to like when we could buy 200 bulls for a little under $2 million, and that worked good. And then we started this genomics things, and the bulls got more expensive. And yes, we bought fewer of them, but then we had to spend more money. And then you start hearing the stories, well, the bulls were so expensive, they started buying females, and that's cutting breeders out. Well, I look at the amount of money that it costs to buy females and the reproduction work you have to do, and I think we went from 2 million to a lot more million pretty quick, and I'm not 100% sure that the math plays out, that there still isn't a real symbiotic relationship with AI and and female programs. When I look at even our program, we're not going to have enough diversity in genetics to ever be closed. I think it was Lloyd who may have said that earlier. We're going to need to continue to rely on the population, the great breeders that are out there to still be the engine of our genetic improvements. So my trends would be globalization, genetics have value, and we're in the middle of a game change, but don't believe the hype.
Yeah, I think, Paul, you touch on all kinds of main items in the news today, and even when you talk about your female program and how some farms have adapted to the services that you as a company need, or other farmers need, or other other breeders, and those services, and how they've had to make a swing towards supplying and providing those services and making a total business out of it. So I think you make the change, you see the collaboration and how it's changed and shifted over the time as well is quite important. Yeah, and I'm going to start with you on our next one because you're pretty passionate about the different genomic blocks, if you will. So I'm going to, and certainly with in Holland with NVI and closely with RZG as well, you can touch on them. What do you feel the major strengths of them are? And you can work your own opinion in on your on that collaboration as well with those indexes in Europe.
Each index has, of course, its own formula and how it comes together. You see that in a group of indexes, if you have the PFT, the Italian index, the Canadian index, and also the German index, they are quite similar. If you've got the type and protein and milk, you do score well on most of these indexes. Where you have the French and the Danish, and now also a little bit more the TPI, if you have your health traits and these, then you do really well in these indexes. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's as you market a lot through a lot of those different indexes, it becomes what do people want? What are they trying to make with that? And some of what are your particular, in your case, some of your embryo markets are driven by some of those indexes as well, I would assume.
Yeah, well, for us, it's the main two main indexes at the moment are still by far TPI. It's worldwide accepted as the index. And then second to that is the RZG, which is a very important index. It's partly because of the Germans are most liberal in releasing their data, so the people, they know the ranking the best. And the German AIs have paid the most money for bulls in Europe, and money counts for when you want to breed for something. So these two indexes are...
No, I think it's good to hear your perspective, because you're working many of them. I think it, even though they have adjustments and they have their strengths, it comes down to profit and what's going to return for yourself and for those clients as well. Moving into that, Paul, I'd ask for some input with some of your, connections that you've experienced with those indexes as well, and share your views.
Yeah, I think we get we often get quite wrapped up in the different indexes, and I actually was refreshing in a number of the presentations from the people who make the indexes. They maybe take themselves less serious than I was concerned they did. We all want to breed again cows that make high quantities, high quality milk in an easy way, and there's not too many different ways. There's not too many ways to skin that cat. We've got GTPI. I agree with Jan. It's the global language. I have the distinct pleasure of being born an English speaker, which means everybody else caters to your needs. It's what GTPI is. It's the English language of breeding. It's the easiest to understand, it's the most common, and it becomes a dominant force. Again, I think a lot of that has to do with the size and scale of the U.S. population. I think those secondary indexes, LPI, RZG, PFD, all the different letters of the alphabet, I think those are generally well thought out indexes that really work for the local commercial dairyman. you know, in the past, they were more relevant to the breeding, to the breeder population, because the breeders in those countries needed to supply the genetics to them. But again, I think we're at a stage now where we're pretty multilingual. We're gonna see, again, using the example of tonight's sale, we're gonna see animals promoted on four different bases with great accuracy. You can pick and choose which ones are important to you, but the beauty of it is that you know which the best animals are. And I think that's a real benefit to say that, you know, this animal may be more moderate for TPI, but she's got a great RZG. It makes her relevant, that makes her have value beyond a milk producing unit. So I do think those secondary indexes provide a nice support or a nice side benefit. I still think TPI is going to lead TPI. I think the U.S. population and GPTAs are going to lead the genetic improvement, and I think we'll see the globalization, and we'll see more and more people relying on the U.S. to make that genetic improvement.
Thanks, Paul. Declan, with certainly APR, and you know, so you can touch on that, and certainly you've been marketing a number of embryos for a number of years, and with over here on primarily on GTPI, I guess, what do you see, and where's that focus and driven amongst your clients as well with the strength within those indexes?
Yeah, for sure, Roger. Obviously, the APR is the Australian profit ranking, so it's like the GTPI or the RZG in Germany. You know, and I guess the strength of that, you know, of that ranking is for pasture-based systems. So if you're a farmer in Australia and you have a pasture-based system, then that the APR system is certainly one that you'll turn to. If you're a, you know, producer in Australia and you're a TMR herd, or you know, you supplementary feed, then a lot of those farmers in the past have turned to the TPI system. Like both of the guys up here have said, it's a global system that everyone respects, and especially when you're looking at genomics. You know, the one thing when I started with ABS was that they said genomics is only as good as your data set. So obviously with the APR system, we're in the infancy of genomic testing in Australia. So we don't have a wide, wide data set with APR. And that's probably one reason that genomics on the TPI system or on the LPI system have played a larger role in Australia. As Roger mentioned, on the embryo side, my job is the sales manager at Butleviano Embryos, and we sell roughly around $2 million of embryos each year. So it's certainly something that we, you know, that I focus on quite heavily. And, you know, like it's been said today, you've got to know your customers, and a lot of our customers are based out of Europe. So we actually look, when I started at Butleview, kind of looked at a lot of those different systems. So we do a lot of mating selections on RZG. We use a lot of bulls that rank well in that country because that's, you know, a lot of the time our end user, so that's quite important. And, you know, it plays a larger role in, you know, different systems are starting to play, you know, a much larger role, you know, in our breeding program. So, yeah, that's probably, you know, the main points I'd like to touch on.
Yeah, certainly, and certainly strong points, Declan. I think, you know, APR doesn't always get, you know, get in the forefront sometimes, but when you get the chance to be there, that's certainly what gets circulated first and foremost within the country. And I think, you know, as being there a number of times and the implementations they've made to try and grasp that feed efficiency and body size condition has certainly always impacted a lot of the drivers behind those changes as well. And I think kind of leads into our next little segment about, you know, is it practical to breed for multiple, you know, indexes? And I'm going to start with Paul on this one. How do you feel about that? Is it practical? And certainly as a peak program, you know, is that something you guys are trying to do inside your program as well at ELTA, Paul?
From that perspective, I think selection for multiple systems, is it possible? Yeah, of course. You know, we had the good fortune, and it was good luck, not always great planning. We have one of the animals within our program, Ransom Marquis is her name. She's in the top two or three animals born in 2013 on LPI, TPI, NVI, and RZG. She, I assume if we found some other indexes to test her on, she'd likely be in the top for those. Again, we're looking for all the same things. I guess the question is it practical? Well, the last time I checked, again, this is a business, you don't generally work to turn gold into silver. And so TPI is what drives the financials of our business, of the breeding industry, very much. It's always nice to pick up those extra byproduct checks, if you will, when you can sell a female or a male based on LPI, RZG, those other things. But ultimately, I think what I see really transitioning and changing in our business is the focus and commitment and scale that's required to breed cattle is really being raised. I think in the past, the analogy would have been that, and many of the great breeders were great, I do think they used art and practical common sense to make the foundation of the great Holstein breed. But today, I think we've really moved to a situation where Holstein cattle breeding takes a level of focus and commitment that makes it more of a sport. You want to be good at it, you have to be focused, you have to be committed, you have to train to do it well. It's like the example of a decathlon. I think if you can do 10 sports, that's great, but nobody knows who does it. It's not that cool. It's the people, you know, it's Usain Bolt's the fastest, and some Kenyan runs the longest time. The specialists are the people who are going to win when it comes to it. So for me, it's that focus and commitment. Again, still that same basis of passion that's required, but it's scale and focus and commitment. And so I really think it's not overly practical to try and be good at everything. You need to decide what you're going to be good at. Again, it's a common theme that has come up from different angles, from different people who are up here killing horses. But for me, I would liken it to the fact that, no longer it's Monday Night Football, it's Tuesday Morning Genomics that's the sport of kings in this room.
I was going to give you a welcome to the U.S., but maybe after Monday Night Football, just got trashed. I'm
a
sure. Packer.
Just for those who are worried, I am moving to Wisconsin. I'm a Packers fan. I won't.
Who's their quarterback?
Good cover. Declan, I'm going to, as you talk about some of your indexes, and obviously people ask you for a lot of advice and selection as well, and I'm just going to add a little bit of a question on that. You talked about some of your embryo clients. I'm going to, just as you sell a lot of embryos, is your primary client breeders or AI companies, particularly as you export? You can kind of turn mm-hmm. that into the same question.
Yeah, for sure. Certainly... I guess I'm a bit of a numbers guy, so I like to analyze a lot of data that we have at the farm. I guess to answer the question, we're actually 50-50. So we sell 50% of our embryos would sell direct to farmers around the world, and then the other 50% we sell through brokers. So like Jan's company, Eurogenes, we sell quite a few embryos through brokers around the world. So obviously, I was quite surprised when I ran the numbers, but it's a 50-50 relationship. So it obviously, for my business, it shows how important, dealing directly with the farmer is, and it shows how important that, brokers around the world are as well for our business. But certainly as I touched on before, Roger, our big clientele is in Europe, so we want an animal for our breeding program that may rank well on GTPI, but we also want an animal that ranks well on some of those systems as well. Certainly, that's where our clients are. So we have to look at their system and we have to adapt and change, and that's certainly something that we've done for the last few years. And as those systems become more important, we've adapted to that change. So we pay a lot of attention on the RZG when we're mating sires, and we certainly want bulls and heifers that rank well in three or four systems. So if they can rank well on the Italian system, or if they can rank well in the GTPI, LPI, that's important for us, because that way I can maximize the investment on that animal. So that that's one of my key roles at the farm, is to maximize investment for the people that own the animals, and certainly if they rank well in those different systems, that allows me to do that. So I think it's a key driver for what I do, but certainly in other areas it may not be. So
yeah, good. Certainly it's always interesting, and in how those relationships are important within that as well. And on this question, you know, it really hit me last year when I was, over with you in Germany. You know, you had one of your live cattle sales, and one of your top seller that day certainly had GTPI. She certainly had RZG, and then she was purchased by a guy that lives in Canada and breeds for GLPI. So I thought that was really interesting. So, you know, it's certainly a heifer that you guys had your hands in. So certainly she had a global attraction, you know, and certainly she touched a lot of bases. So I think you have a lot of influence and input to how you feel those practicalities of those indexes blend.
Yes, especially for these top animals, it doesn't really matter anymore where they are, if they are in Germany, Canada, or whatever, Argentina, or Australia, whatever country they are, they're going to be found, and people want to work with them. So that was at that time that the top heifer in Germany sold to the Canadians. What we feel in choosing our mating size is that we see it as an extra safety if they rank well in as well the European system, as well in the U.S. system, as long as there are enough, the sires have enough data in the reference population. You need to have enough daughters in the reference population. Bulls like Robust, who had no daughters in the reference population in Europe, it does not make much sense to rank them Robust daughters based on the European rankings. But if you got bulls like we now see with the Planet Suns and so on that have daughters on both sides of the ocean, then it gives us an extra safe, you know, we feel more comfortable if they rank well in both systems, so that we like to see that.
Yeah, great. I think it's and you can see the rewards when they do have the polish of all of them combined into one as well. As we talked even earlier this morning with the AI group, and they're seeing their changes with genomics versus proven, I think it's always interesting even within countries. And Declan, I'm going to, you know, start with you on this one. And what was the usage of genomic young sires, if you will, prior to genomics within Australia? And where do you see it currently on those amongst the breeders within the country?
Yeah, for sure, Roger. I think Australia, as a population, likes type cattle. Obviously, we all like to milk good cows, but you know, Australia does put a bit of emphasis on the type. When I started back in ABS in 2009, it was right about the start of Aftershock and Destry. So it was my first day on the job, and I remember Russell Manton come up to me and he said, "Have a look at these, you can't tell anyone," and he showed me a genomic proof on Destry and Aftershock. Those two bulls, we sold that much semen on it, it was incredible. We had a lot of breeders in Australia that, followed the genomic type, and I think we've discovered some of the greatest bulls in history with, Atwood and certainly Gold Chip, and there's many more, as I mentioned, Aftershock and Destry. So, I think on the genomic type side, Australia is still, very passionate about genomics on that. With the proven bulls, we still have quite a high use of proven bulls on the, on the production side. So, Australian breeders, depending, as I touched on before, on the systems, kind of depends if you're a pasture-based system or if you're on a total mixed ration. Each breeding program have different objectives, but certainly we see more of the proven bulls probably used on the pasture-based, and because that's what works with the APR. On genomic APR, it's probably one of the only systems in the world I've seen that the proven bulls are higher than the genomic bulls on APR. Certainly you don't see that on many systems, so I think the pasture-based farmers use a lot of proven bulls. And then on the management side, on the TMR and feed feedlots, we see more of the young genomic bulls coming through, because I think it suits that system. And obviously they're looking at more of the North American influence on those bulls. So.
Yeah, it's interesting that how it even is split within amongst the population within the country, how it gets split up, that you don't always see as well. Jan, certainly is Holland and your friendly neighboring countries. Where do you see and what have you noticed in those genomic sire, proven sire trends?
In the Netherlands, it was it took off a little slower than in other countries. I would say it was mostly for two reasons. First, we had the press was in the beginning quite skeptical to genomics. And the second was the Siemens sales companies. They stayed selling daughter proven product for quite a long time. NVI is the formula in the Netherlands, and they obviously only had the data on their daughter proven bulls. So for that reason, they could not compete with young bulls because they do not have GNVIs on those. So for that reason, now that is changing with the GMAs, that more of these companies have access to GNVIs on their bulls, so they also actively start marketing those bulls, and therefore also their clients are now changing to it. Germany has a huge acceptance of genomics. It's much higher than in the Netherlands. France is really high. Scandinavia seems to be quite high. I'm not really into that. England is a little bit more slower than other, more traditional than other European countries. So,
yeah,
those are the countries that we are active in.
Always interesting when you get politics into the landscape as well, that you always ask yourself, is it coming at the cost of genetic progress within the country as well? So, Paul, moving on to you with that question, and certainly within the scope of the AI company, and as you've seen sales and business and the trends as well.
As we make no illusion about, and John probably showed with full colors, in terms of genomics, Altus drank the Kool-Aid. We're very committed. It suits our clientele very well, and we were early adopters. So we've in the 5 years that have been completed that I would call in the genomic era, we've gone from about under 30% genomics to nearly 70% genomics in terms of our global sales. And of course, we would be higher percentages in the U.S. and Germany and Canada, and a little lower percentages in some of the countries, as Jan mentioned, that either have political or skeptical reasons for not being genomic. That trend is an interesting one, because it would lead you to believe that there's less proven semen being sold, but in fact, what it amounts to is that at Alta, at least 100% of our growth has been genomic. We still sell as many proven units today as we did 5 years ago. It's just that the growth has come on the side of genomic pools. And I think we have to look at the landscape that genomics was introduced in. When genomics came out, we had likely what I would argue was the testament to the quality of great breeding. We had what I think is one of the greatest crops of bulls. When you look at bulls like Alta Iota, Dorsey, Freddy, O-Style, Schottel, Planet, that those group of proven bulls held up there very long and very well. And so it was a time when we were trying to introduce a new technology in the face of a very strong and established group of bulls. And it may have made it a challenge at first. And we've succeeded. We see the quality of genetics and genomics, and we see the influence that those great bulls have had in terms of, today creating all the questions about outcross and the need for outcross. I just editorialize, if anybody in the audience started buying outcross, we'd start making it. The interesting thing I think will be is, I think we're in a little bit of a valley. We had that great group of daughter proven bulls that existed at the top of the list, were very well proven, very accurately proven, that held on very strong. And now we're going through a phase of that distance from K. I heard that earlier. I don't really know what that means, but we're getting a little more of a challenge there in terms of reliability. But we're gonna have a renaissance for daughter proven bulls, I think, when we find out which of the mogul ransom bulls that are out there that look good right now is really the best one. He's gonna rank pretty well even against the very youngest bulls, and when we start having we have the diversity of all the different bloodlines is a great opportunity for genomics. When we have, and I call them a double genomic, a bull whose sire and maternal grandsire are both genomic at the time of sampling, when we find out through daughter proofs which of those was the best combination, had rolled the right luck, they're going to rank extremely high. We look at how high mogul ranks still now. Wait till we see which of those mogul robust sons is really the best one. He's going to rank darn high against even some real young bulls. So I think there'll be a renaissance. We've got the fact that not as many people want to buy them. They make a lot of semen. They're going to be high. They're going to be priced right. I think we're going to continue to see a real strong relevance of daughter proven bulls moving forward. I don't see us going to chopping bulls' heads off when they're 36 months of age. At least that's my prediction.
Hey, that's good. I think there's only so many barns and so many stalls, but you need units to get there, and certainly the clients are the drivers behind that. Kind of coming up to one final question before we open it up to the floor, as we heard from different aspects and the return on investment, and certainly presentation yesterday about genomic testing as many females as you can, increasing the reference population. Jan, starting with you, is this a tool or something that you see within Holland, that they are large herds or commercial herds are doing a lot of genomic testing within a herd environment?
Yeah, it's really promoted big by the local herd books in Europe, because they need it for their reference population to get enough data. They think with the preferable treatment that we now see on the bulls that are being used, that they need more female input data to keep the reliability up. So it's really promoted.
And you see, it's a tool, certainly with when you put dollars to it, it's interesting to see that it's being grasped, and hopefully that database and that reference population will keep moving it forward as well. Paul, you come from different populations as well, but certainly Alta's grabbed a hold of that genomic testing as well. When I was there, it was certainly, as Ian used the word promotion, you guys use it as a tool. In-house and globally, what's your perspective on commercialization genomic testing?
Yeah, so on the side of genomic testing, I think there's a lot of different facets to it. It's done obviously very intensively within this room, within the breeding population or the near breeding population, which I think is what we would call anybody who's a purebred focused on breeding herd. But we see it really moving rapidly into the commercial population. I think, again, it's a little bit goes back to the third trend I mentioned under trends. We're in such a fast rate of change, we're not exactly sure how even best to use the technology. And so it's no different than a new drug for a protocol that you might use. We're still trying to find the best ways to incorporate it. And so I got to have lunch with Zoetis, and we talked about that. And when you're looking to try and incorporate these tools, it takes some time to find the right and most fruitful path. I think we have to be, and I was, not surprised, but really glad to hear that everybody was very honest on the AI panel, as we always are. We can't hold the illusion that testing animals that are 300, 400, 500 GTPI points behind the mean of AI bulls is going to hold a lot of fruitful value to the breeding population. We need to find ways to maintain that relevance and keep them engaged. I would add to Jan's statement about herd books doing testing in Europe. I do think, again, RZG and GTPI in the reverse order are popular indexes because they're widely available. The drawback of being widely available is it's hard to protect any value. When we look at the more protected indexes that happen in some other countries, I do see a lot of interesting work, at least I look at it as interesting work being done on feed efficiency, hoof health, these type of things, because they hope to have some means of capturing that value. And so I think that's an advantage or opportunity for those secondary breeding populations to be looking for areas of value in terms of proprietary information on some of these emerging areas. I think it's going to be very hard for that to be developed within the intensely competitive GTPI marketplace. In terms of commercial testing, I think we're at the tip of the iceberg. It has to be simple for me to understand. If genomic testing was free, you'd always do it. if you can define more and more ways to create value through it, it'll become more and more prevalent. And I think as we become more adept, maybe more focused in how we manage a commercial herd, I think that's a trend that's been going on for a long time. I think we'll find more and more ways to leverage genomic knowledge, genetic knowledge, and it'll become a tool that that will be at some point genomic testing will be an SOP for every animal, because it'll either be needed for a drug protocol or a culling decision or a breeding decision. I don't know when that'll be or how that'll be, but I think we have to be open to understanding and finding ways to create value in that regard.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I think it's we can do all the testing we want. I think it's incorporating and how we're going to use that information once we get it's important. Declan, in Australia, has that practice been promoted and used? Certainly, there's lots of large herd environments. What's the landscape there?
Yeah, I think Australia has been a little bit slower to catch up on the genomics, and that's just because DNA. Yeah,
DNA.
It's just DNA. I think what it is I mentioned right at the start that genomics to me is only as good as your data set. So Australia obviously don't have a large population of dairy cattle compared to the US, so therefore our data set isn't as large. And for me and for a lot of farmers out there in Australia, that's means it's less reliable. So people are more skeptical to use the technology or use the tool to make those important decisions like Paul mentioned. I think as time goes on and there's some agencies in Australia, Holstein Australia and ADHIS that have done an amazing job to try to grow that data set by collecting samples from large herds. The more data set we can get in there, the more samples, the stronger the technology can be. So, I think in the future, if they continue to do that and understand the importance of it, I think that technology will certainly grow in those larger herd environments. I certainly think it has a place, and I certainly think, under our system, they have certain traits like Paul touched on with, the mastitis resistance and feed efficiency. Australia's been very good at capturing that information, over the years. So, I think it will continue to grow, in those large dairies. So.
Yeah, good, Declan. Thank you. Open it up to the floor. I've got a couple questions for the guys, but I certainly would like to open it up to the floor for questions for this this global panel. We don't get utilize these guys very much. Usually we're at an event where they're pretty attracted to lots of other actions. So I certainly open it up to the floor. Declan, the one question that came to my mind was the other day I was in California, it was in the supermarket, and there was my first experience, and I don't get out very much, so I don't get to travel very often to see what could be out there, but it was my first experience the other day in California when I went to the store of a bottle of A2 milk. And certainly the first time I ever heard A2 was in Australia. And then when I got my updates for the sale catalog yesterday, I was inputting A2 into the catalog. So it's one thing I wanted to ask you about, particularly in Australia, this audience that haven't been there, and it adapted it or grasped that A2 perspective of protein in the milk certainly as quicker as anybody. And now it's starting to, I noticed it in California the other day. Give a little background on that and how those dairymen get rewarded, if you will, within your country.
Which heifer are you going to buy?
A violation.
Paul.
Peak. Roger, certainly A2 milk has been growing in Australia. It's probably started, it started probably 6 years ago. The technology came out of New Zealand, so it was quite closer to home. I think the industry in Australia has done an amazing job of kind of marketing the product. When you go down to Australia, you hear on the radio, you see on the TV, You know, you see ads about A2 milk. So, you know, certainly it's changed the industry down there because, you know, it's a premium. So it's like organic milk. You know, it's, you know, the farmer's getting a premium for A2. So obviously, you know, a part of the population in your herd is going to be an A2, AT positive. And so what a lot of herds have done in Australia in recent times is tested their whole herd, and then the A2 positive cows, they'll run in a separate herd. They put them in a different milk tank, and they get a premium for that milk. So, you know, for a little bit of extra work to have two different herds, you know, you're getting paid a premium on the A2 milk. You know, the industry have certainly have adapted the technology. You know, it's certainly quite popular in the country, and I think it will grow around the world, you know, as more markets, you know, catch on to the benefits of A2 milk. So.
Well, it's certainly been promoted. I'm just going to just ask a question. Paul's got a couple comments. In that premium, I'm just going to use a number that was referenced. Is it around that 15 to 20% premium that those dairies will pay the producer? Is that a close proximity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that yes. would be correct. Yeah.
Okay. And which is, you know, particularly one of the dairymen that I spoke to was milking about 3,000 cows, and he had about 1,500 A2 cows. So, you know, that was a pretty nice premium check for that milk. Paul, you had some comments regarding that.
I just when we talk about a couple of these, and these are niches, but I think we also need to realize, as I got thinking about after somebody said, you know, how much genetic improvement are we willing to give up for pulled? Well, that's a great question. Intuitively, you should say you shouldn't change the efficiency because of pulled, but if we were to try and look at our business a little bit more like Coke or Pepsi does, we'd say if we could start a campaign where we said we've reduced the need to dehorn animals, we've made them mastitis resistant so they don't need drugs, and we've made the milk a healthier product, you know, maybe with the price we'd get for the little bit less milk we'd make might be more valuable. Now, I'm always skeptical about how that trickles down to the level of the breeding population and the producing population, because generally, It's Danone and Fonterra that are going to make the money on that, but it is something to think about, or something I maybe hadn't thought as much about until these days. Is if we put out those three press releases instead of some of the others that we're faced with, would we have more demand and then more opportunity to exploit our product? So it's not always it's probably why I'm not on the AI panel, but. You know, it's not always about the last little bit of genetic improvement. It's also about making sure we have a sustainable industry for a real long time. And so we can make three real good news stories. Maybe we don't need to make the last 2 pounds of protein improvement.
I think that's certainly valued. Our consumer is our driver behind their quality product, certainly. From the floor, Dan?
Dan, that's me.
Yep, we got you.
Is it on?
You're live.
Oh, okay. First of all, I'd like to say how great it is to work with the Butler View family, right from Jeff all the way, including Todd and Declan and Ashley, and even their farmhands are great. They make me breakfast when I'm there. But anyway, Declan, not that I don't believe every single word you ever tell me or email me or text me, but I've seen a few raised eyebrows when I tell people that I have six out of the first six bulls likely going to stud. So now that you're not under oath here with a hand down a Bible or anything, but you know, with God and everybody that's here, is that a likelihood or not?
Well, I was telling someone yesterday, Dan, after you said that, there's another tab on your spreadsheet that you missed, so.
I think he's saying, watch out where the next six don't go. So.
You can have a barbecue.
Declan is part politician, so you can certainly believe every word that he says, but he's got certainly a good character to drive it forward. So we're pretty much on schedule, and I certainly want to try and keep that as we're wrapping up, you know, towards some good social evening and some opportunities this evening with the live cat with the sale. And with that, we're going to take a short break and come back to wrap up. And we got certainly another presentation. But certainly with the global, the interest and the miles that these guys have traveled to get here, certainly show your great appreciation for their information.